You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 21st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author of the highly acclaimed new book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, Nick Turse will be here with us. Going to be a little heavy, folks. Also on the program today, we're a week away from sequester. What will be cut? What will its implications be? Get used to it, folks. Here it comes. Also on the program today, as John Kerry signaled where he will land on the question of permitting the Keystone XL pipeline. Also on the program today, Republican chances in 2014, 2016, and beyond. And in the better half, I will get to that phone call that I placed on that AM talk radio show over the weekend. All right, folks. First up, this is a little bit disturbing. Pew poll just came out that basically says the most important priority for the American public right now, at the top of the list, reducing the deficit. Then guns, immigration, and down at the bottom of the list, of course, is climate change. For all Americans, there's variances depending on party and whatnot, but that is primarily the order of priorities. So with that in mind, I guess the American public is about to learn a lesson in austerity. I am still not convinced that Americans fully appreciate what's going to happen this year and afterwards. And this, of course, was a gift that the American people got from the Republican hostage taking and the Democratic, or at least the administration's, capitulation to that hostage taking. We'll talk more about the sequester later in the program. But first, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to author Nick Turse. I turn my camera on. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You, as a listener to the Majority Report, can get a free audiobook download right now. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not pick up Helene Olin's Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, as an audiobook right now for free at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Do it now. It's free.
You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah. And you wasn't alone. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton.
Also, folks, I didn't mention this on the show today, but tomorrow on the program, Friday, we'll have Chris Rosen on. And if we can get somebody who is willing to cut in that little phrase where he said, "I'm working for the Huffington Post now," into his theme song, we'll see if we get somebody to send it in to majorityreporters@gmail.com. So if you're good with music or good with editing or bad at it, but somehow luck out and do a good job one time, then go ahead and do it. All right. See you tomorrow. Well, talk to you tomorrow.
I turned my feelings on. I turned my feelings on the side.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program, after literally weeks of scheduling snafus and whatnot, the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, Nick Turse. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Your book has gotten incredible acclaim and well-deserved. I want to start with the story of how you came to write this book. But before we get to that, Kill Anything. Well, let's start with that. How did you how did you come to write this book?
You know, I really stumbled upon this topic. I was a graduate student at the time, and I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans. And I used to go down to the National Archives, and I was trying to find basically hard data, official military reports to match up with self-report material, basically what veterans had told us about their service, when and where they served in Vietnam, what they were doing at the time. And on one of these frequent trips, I had struck out in every research avenue that I pursued. And at the end of 2 weeks, it was my last day there, I went to an archivist that I normally worked with, and I told him that I couldn't go back to my boss empty-handed. I needed something, you know, at least a lead to bring back. And he thought about it for a couple moments, and then he said a few words to me that really changed my life. He asked me if I thought that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress. And I told him I thought that was an excellent hypothesis, and I asked what he had on war crimes. And within an hour, I was searching through box after box, thousands upon thousands of pages of reports about massacres, murders, rape, torture, assault, mutilation. It was a catalog of horrors. And I realized very quickly that these documents from a secret Pentagon task force called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group, I realized that they weren't in the literature anywhere. I decided that I wanted to work with them, and that's really what set me off on the path that led to Kill Anything That Moves.
I mean, that is, you know, what people have hailed as your book being so important. I mean, you know, and I keep hearing. I've read a couple of interviews and seen some interviews with you, and the number, I guess, there's about 30,000 books that have been written on Vietnam, and it is. It's a stunning accomplishment to 30 years later, 40 years later, write a book that actually explain something new and so profound about the war as yours. What and it is centered around that notion of that these atrocities were not one-offs, as we sort of have been under the mistaken assumption, but that there is something not quite systemic, but we'll get to that. But how is it that, I mean, how is it that the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group, I mean, that all of that information was sitting there and no one had ever looked at it? Was it because this archivist had offered it to you in a way that nobody else had been offered? I mean, it's stunning.
It stunned me too. And I asked him, who's worked with these documents? And he told me that people had looked at one or two cases, but never at the full collection at that time. So, I think one reason for this was the fact that the task force was kept secret during the war. It was operated unofficially out of the Pentagon, out of the Army Chief of Staff's office. So it really wasn't on the books in some way. So when these records were declassified by the Army, and I think possibly mistakenly, it was just a mass declassification, no one really was new to look for them. So they just sat in the archives. I just happened to, I was lucky enough that the archivist pointed me towards them.
And so let's talk about the title of your book, because your stories of, or the stories that you've captured, from the archives and from hundreds of interviews, the phrase "kill anything that moves" came up time and time again in one iteration or another on the ground in terms of what the orders were for specific platoons and for the military personnel on the ground, but in some ways it also could be a description of, in fact, what the sort of the broad strategic goals of the war itself were. Before we get to that sort of that aspect of it, tell us the story of Jamie Hendry, who was a medic, where you first came across the use of that phrase.
Sure. Jamie, he really affected my life. I found him first in those Vietnam War Crimes Working Group records. I read about him, and then I went and tracked him down and met him in person. And Jamie was, before the war, a self-described hippie living in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district. But he was drafted, and he became a medic, and a very good one. He saved a lot of American lives, and the men who served with him said that he was one of the finest soldiers that they'd come across. But Jamie was really shocked by what he saw going on in Vietnam. On his first day in the field, he told me that he watched the point man, the lean man of his patrol, detain a young girl and molest her right out on a trail. And he thought to himself, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he just watched a litany of atrocities take place. A young boy who was detained and beaten and executed for no reason, an old man who was used for target practice, a prisoner who was beaten up and thrown off a cliff. There was a man who was held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. And Jamie watched all this, but when he spoke up about the brutality, his life was threatened by other members of his unit. And even his friends came up to him afterwards and told him, look, you need to keep your mouth shut, or you're going to get shot in the back during a firefight, and no one's going to be the wiser. So Jamie did keep his mouth shut, but he kept his eyes open, and he kept cataloging everything that he saw, including, this culminated really in a February 8th, 1968 incident. His unit pulled into a small hamlet, and they rounded up all the people there, which was about 19 women and children. And Jamie was taking a break, smoking a cigarette, and he heard the commanding officer and a subordinate officer on the radio. And a lieutenant asked, what should I do with these civilians? And the officer, the captain, West Point trained captain, answered, you know the orders that came down from higher this morning. Kill anything that moves. So Jamie heard this, and he hopped up and you know, made his way towards where the civilians were and where the captain was. He wanted to intervene, but he arrived just seconds late, just in time to see five men open up on full automatic with their M16s and kill all the civilians there. Jamie watched this happen, and he said that, you know, 30 seconds afterwards, he vowed that he'd blow the whistle on it. So when he came home, he went right to an Army lawyer, and he reported it. But the lawyer told him to keep quiet. He said that there were a million ways that the Army could make him disappear. He went to an Army criminal investigator, but this man threatened him. But he kept at it. He went out, and he found a civilian lawyer and asked for advice. And this man told him to get some political backing. So he wrote to a couple of congressmen, but neither of them would return his letters. And then he decided to go public. He spoke out at public forums. He published an article. He held a press conference. He went on the radio. But he just couldn't get any traction. And eventually he gave up. And it was only when I showed up on his doorstep with several phone book size stacks of records, you know, 40 years later, only then did he know that the Army had conducted a thorough investigation and corroborated everything that he said. But, of course, that was kept secret from him and from the American public. And what would have been the first story about a My Lai-style massacre wasn't fully exposed until 40 years later.
And in many respects, I mean, that is, or at least in some respects, that is the one of the big takeaways from your book is that the My Lai massacre, which was, I think, perceived as an aberration in some ways, sort of like what the worst thing that could happen in that context. And but the book essentially outlines that there were, if not in the size, but at least there were, I mean, I don't know, hundreds or more of these. I mean, that it was in many respects standard operating procedures. Is that fair?
It is. You know, My Lai is atypical basically for two reasons. One, the number of civilians killed at one time is very large at My Lai. 500 civilians killed over a period of 4 hours. Most massacres were smaller than this. But otherwise, it isn't atypical. The other thing that's atypical about it is the fact that it was thoroughly investigated. There's never been another military investigation, at least during the Vietnam War, that was as comprehensive as the investigation into My Lai. And perhaps the most telling thing about that investigation is the fact that the military put a general named Pierce, General Pierce, in charge, and his Pierce panel looked at My Lai. And as they were looking at it, what they found was at the very same moment that 500 civilians were being killed at My Lai, there was another hamlet nearby called My Khe, a totally different unit on a different mission, went to My Khe and killed somewhere between 50 and 150 Vietnamese there. And this was, they figured this out, it was suppressed at the time, and it was never fully made public in a way that My Lai was. But the fact that the military can look into this and find, you know, on the very same day, two different massacres, two different villages, two different units, it really put the lie to the fact that that My Lai was somehow an isolated incident or committed by bad apples. And once the military saw that, they got scared, and this is what caused the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group to be created. They created this task force because they were basically afraid of what else might bubble up from Vietnam, and whenever they could, this task force would try and tamp down allegations and make sure that they didn't explode in the press the way My Lai did.
I mean, that is also one of the really incredible sort of, I mean, that this that the in fact the existence of the working group is in some respects proof of that premise, that this is not an isolated incident. In fact, that they needed to develop an entire apparatus to essentially maintain a fictional narrative of the whole war in many respects.
That's exactly right, and I think it's you know, that it's one of the major reasons why, as you mentioned, there are 30,000 books on the Vietnam War. But if you read most of them, basically when they if they talk about Vietnamese civilians suffering at all, it's in the context of only My Lai. So this was a real victory on the part of the military. They were able to contain that alternate narrative of the war and really reduce it to me lies. So you have this one horrific massacre, but just one stand in for what was pervasive suffering, what I came to see as a signature aspect of the conflict. And this is a conflict that in which millions of Vietnamese were killed, millions more made wounded or made refugees by deliberate U.S. policies, like the use of almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. So we're talking about deliberate policies that were dictated at the highest levels of the military. But from their narrative and the one that we've mostly seen in history books, it's all been collapsed into me-lie.
I mean, is that is that fair to say that kill anything that moves was in many respects sort of the overarching policy? I mean, because to me the only parallel that I can make is sort of how our torture regime occurred in Iraq was essentially a combination of a deliberate loosening of the standards of what to in terms of orders that were issued down from the civilian leadership through the top military leadership down to the military personnel in Iraq, and then also a certain amount of improvisation that is taking place on all levels going in both directions, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think it's a fair assessment. You know, I mentioned that the phrase "kill anything that moves." I first noticed it as orders handed down during the massacre that Jamie Henry witnessed, and I realized that as I studied the war further, I saw this phrase or variations of it pop up in various investigations. It was the order that was handed down before the My Lai massacre by Captain Medina. He told the men that they were to go in and kill anything that moves. I found this this phrase repeated in a court-martial documents relating to a massacre that Marines carried out in 1967. And I kept seeing it over and over again. And it really, I began to take it as a dictum, a shorthand for how the war was really fought. And I think that in many respects, it was a kill anything that moves type of war. The U.S., as I mentioned, the top command, and this came down from the Pentagon, came up with policies that made it inevitable that large numbers of Vietnamese civilians would be killed or wounded during the war. We'll never know exactly how many Vietnamese civilians died, but the best estimates we have indicate that there were 2 million civilian dead. Add to that about 5.3 million civilian wounded. The U.S. government came up with its estimate of 11 million Vietnamese made refugees. The latest studies show that as many as 4 million Vietnamese were exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. So you have suffering on an almost unimaginable scale. And the military high command and even the White House just had to know that this was going on. It was impossible not to see it from their vantage point.
I mean, the war, having a war crimes working group, I mean, it seems to me would be the first piece of evidence on some level, because it's set up not to figure out how can we prevent this. It's essentially set up to figure out how can we continue to maintain this sort of broader policy without it having any type of implications in terms of accountability and in terms of providing any type of informed consent, I guess. I mean, I don't know how else to say it, to the American people as to what was actually going on at the time.
That's right. The War Crimes Working Group never worked to prevent war crimes, to prosecute war crimes, to put guidance out into the field. This strictly was for tracking purposes, to keep the White House appraised, to keep the Secretary of Defense appraised, and to make sure that whenever it was possible that they could bury investigations the way they did, Jamie Henry's investigation.
I mean, do you think that the strategy that we were pursuing in Vietnam was essentially an attrition strategy? Tell us about that and how you think that may have sort of, it almost included in the description, the title of the strategy. I mean, speaks in some respects to what it led to. But just tell us a little bit about the attrition strategy.
Sure. You know, the war was fought, you know, this wasn't a classic World War I type of war where you had two armies facing off across a battlefield trying to take territory and eventually an enemy capital. The Vietnamese revolutionaries were fighting a guerrilla conflict. They weren't trying to take territory, nor were the Americans. So the Americans were looking for, you know, some sort of metric to prove that they were winning. And they seized on one that they had used during the second half of the Korean War, which was you know, the attrition strategy and the use of body count. And the basic idea is that the U.S. would kill its way to victory and reach this this mythic crossover point that, that the Americans were always chasing. The idea was that you'd be killing more guerrillas than the enemy could put into the field. And at that point, the enemy would assess the war in a rational way and decide to abandon it. They'd see that they were losing and make a rational decision. Of course, the Vietnamese saw this as a nationalist struggle, a revolution, and a continuation of their anti-colonial fight against the French, who the U.S. had backed during the 1950s. So they weren't looking at it as a ledger sheet of credits and debits. But the Americans never saw it a different way. They just couldn't conceptualize the way the Vietnamese saw the war, and they basically only had one option to exercise. To continue the attrition strategy, and that was to apply more and more firepower on the countryside in an effort to, you know, break the hold between the guerrillas and the peasant population, to drive the Vietnamese from the countryside and isolate the guerrillas. And on the ground, this really had disastrous consequences for the Vietnamese civilian population. Because of, one, the firepower raining down, and also American troops on the ground learned very quickly that that their commanders weren't discerning about what types of bodies. They just wanted Vietnamese bodies. So they could, as in the case at My Lai, claim they'd killed 128 enemy troops at a cost of no American lives with only a handful of weapons to show for it. You were supposed to turn in your weapons to show the body count was accurate. But American commanders weren't discerning about that. So the American troops learned that, that any bodies would do, and they could shoot first because no one would ask questions after.
I mean, it that aspect of it, you know, I mean, trying to sort of you divorce yourself on some level from the and part of the process, I guess, is completely divorcing yourself to execute that type of strategy. You're completely divorcing yourself from the implications of humanity. But it is a real sort of, and I guess, you know, it was in many respects sort of McNamara's corporatization of war in some way. And it's that sort of same corporatization, frankly, that we see, you know, in a lot of domestic policies, frankly, that look at just simply numbers. And but this is the most extreme case of it, where you're completely stripping away the humanity. And I think you've described it, or it's been described as, you know, stacking bodies like you would a stack of logs, essentially.
That's exactly right. You know, Bob McNamara had in the decade before he became Secretary of Defense, headed Ford Motor Company. And he really thought that he could run the Pentagon and basically run the Vietnam War the same way that he'd run Ford, just as a business. He brought in technocrats. He brought in a lot of computers. They crunched numbers. And he really thought that he could win the war this way. But he never had any other solution. You know, when he saw that they weren't winning, the only option available was to just increase the firepower. And as I said, it was a nightmare for Vietnamese civilians.
Let's talk about some of the other stories of individuals. I mean, you traveled to Vietnam. You spoke to victims of this war. You spoke to soldiers who committed these atrocities, to ranking military personnel who may have, I guess, ordered. But what was the reaction? I mean, as you went to these interviews with this information, were the reactions, I mean, dissimilar? How did they relate relative to the story of the medic? I mean, I imagine that medic felt some type of indication that finally you know, a mission that he had been on that he had given up because of it just was failing in terms of exposing these things and the systemic nature of them. How did other people react?
Well, among American veterans, as you might imagine, there was a full spectrum of responses. There were some individuals I talked to. You know, I got in touch with a man who I knew from records had admitted to carrying out acts of torture on enemy prisoners and civilian detainees using electrical torture and water torture, what we refer now to as waterboarding. And I got in touch with him, and I asked him about this, and he was completely unrepentant. He told me that, you know, he thought what he'd done was right. If he was in a Vietnam-type situation again, he would do the exact same thing. He thought it was the right thing to do for the war effort, and he saw nothing wrong with how he carried out the war. And, of course, there were other soldiers that I, or veterans that I talked to, who you know, had a very different reaction. There's one who he really sticks out in my mind. You know, I talked to him for you know, several hours. He was very jovial. He had an infectious laugh. We talked about a lot of different aspects of the war, and he got quiet. And he told me he wanted to tell me about a member of his unit. And he talked about how they went into a village, and they were setting it on fire, burning it down, which was basically standard operating procedure. This was another way that the Americans sought to break the connection between the guerrillas and the peasants in the countryside. So they were burning down a village, and a woman came up and grabbed this other soldier, this GI, by the arm and was yelling at him. You know, obviously she was yelling about her home being burned down, all her possessions being burnt up. And he said that the GI pushed her away, and then he took his rifle and hit her squarely in the nose with the butt of his rifle. And broke her nose. There was blood everywhere. She was screaming. And this GI just turned around and walked away laughing. And the man who was telling me the story then got very quiet, and he said, you know, a couple moments later, you know that the GI in that story was me. And I really had a tough time, you know, connecting up the man that I was talking to the one from the story. And he told me that he had a very hard time believing what his 19-year-old self had done. He couldn't imagine how he had broken this woman's nose and walked away laughing, and how he had done, you know, other things in Vietnam that he wasn't proud of. And he said that, you know, at the time, he didn't really think anything of it. But in the years since, he couldn't help but think of it on a regular basis, that this had really stayed with him. It was something that he'd grappled with, you know, his entire life. And for many of the veterans that I talked to, this was the case. You know, they were little more than boys when they were sent to Vietnam, and they've been living with the consequences ever since.
Were any of these people that you these former soldiers that you had tracked down via the documents that you found, were they aware that their actions had been investigated? I mean, were they brought in and interviewed contemporaneously or at any time? How did the Atrocities Working Group, how did they, acquire their the information in their reports?
Well, these were, the records are basically the sworn testimony of recently returned American veterans, or even at the time active duty soldiers. So most of these men did remember that they had been interviewed, but of course, 40 years had passed. Most of them had never heard anything more of it. And you know, there was one veteran that I talked to. He told me that you know, he had talked with you know, a therapist about his you know, what he had been through in Vietnam, and he had told this this therapist, he said, you know, I know that somewhere there are records, but he said, I don't know how, you know, where they're squirreled away, you know. So these men knew that that records existed, but they had no idea how to get them. Other people thought that they'd just been, you know, destroyed in the time since. You know, Jamie Henry, the medic who I mentioned who witnessed the massacre, you know, he had no idea that the Army had had corroborated everything that he said. He felt exceptionally vindicated when I showed him these records and showed that, you know, dozens of other men from his unit had finally spoken up and they'd given sworn testimony attesting to the very same things that Jamie had seen. But he had no idea that these records were out there to be found. You know, he had just he'd moved on with his life and given up any hope of ever exposing what had happened.
And the victims or the witness to atrocities that you found in Vietnam, I mean, how are they processing the other end of that story? Or of these specific, you know, incidences.
Sure. I went to Vietnam with these stacks of documents in hand. I was looking for witnesses and survivors who could fill in the Vietnamese side of the story, and explain what it was like from their point of view. But when I went to Vietnam and I'd asked them about this one specific spasm of violence, what I heard over and over again from the Vietnamese was what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and shells and helicopter gunships, about how they had to negotiate every aspect of their life around the American war, what it was like to try and figure out when to dash out of your bunker to try and get some water or forage for food or relieve yourself. All these, just the day-to-day of their lives and how they had to negotiate every aspect around the American war. And very quickly, I came to understand that this was really the story of the war, that the records that I had, the American testimony, it helped to punctuate it, it helped to fill in the gaps. But was really what was missing from the Vietnam literature was this Vietnamese civilian side of the war. And quickly that transformed my project, and it made Kill Anything That Moves a very different book than it would have been otherwise.
And that is also, I think, the parts that's the most instructive in terms of the implications, because we can look at Iraq and, you know, as far as the American body politic and the American consciousness is, well, that war is over and, wipe our hands of it and it's all done. And frankly, I think people, you know, felt that way a couple of years ago. You know, it was just all but for the formalities of leaving. Yet the implications in the state of war continue there in many respects.
Yeah, and you know, as I was writing this book, of course, I was looking at the current wars, and I thought that there was there were some real parallels there. You know, since America is constantly involved in military conflicts abroad, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, these last years. I really thought it was important to do my best to try and show, what war is really like. I think it's important that Americans understand, what war is like, especially for the people who live with it every day, and that's civilians. You know, wars cause, our wars cause immense suffering, but the stories of civilians affected by America's wars rarely make the front pages of the newspapers or lead the nightly news. And I think that if Americans are called upon to send their sons and daughters to war, they ought to have a clear idea of what it means for the sons and daughters of people overseas.
I mean, to the extent that the your book sort of exposes that My Lai was not an isolated incident, that it was an example of really what was the character and the nature of the war that we were waging on this country in many respects. Is that analogy in that My Lai is not such a isolated event, is that analogy, can that be made in terms of, and it may be to extent you just did made that analogy, that Vietnam was also not so special relative to the implications of war wherever we go. I mean, you know, like you say, I mean, in Iraq, we, by our own conservative estimates, killed well over 100,000 civilians, and that's probably significantly on the low end. By our own estimates, 4 million refugees, two that had to leave the country, two within the country. I mean,
in some sense, is there an attempt by both our government, and because I think our government has clearly learned the lessons that they learned from Vietnam were found more or as much in the establishment of that atrocities working group as anything else, that, you know, the lesson they're going to learn is that you really have to keep this information from the American public. I mean, that was one of the things that they clearly learned. But does your book expose that notion that that Vietnam was not a different war? It was maybe different in terms of the size, but in terms of the implications and what it does to the civilian population, at the very least, is very much consistent with all our wars.
Well, you know, I have studied today's wars, and I have to say that I don't think the killing of civilians by U.S. forces today is near the scale of the carnage in Vietnam, you know, specifically the ways that artillery and air power are used, at least from what I've seen, are radically different. But that said, you know, and as you mentioned, you know, civilians still die on a regular basis in our war zones, be it Iraq or Afghanistan, many due to the violence set off by America's invasions and occupations and the resulting civil strife. And of course, others have been killed directly by U.S. bombing, from helicopter gunships, and from troops on the ground. And still more have been wounded, and others have been made refugees. And despite the best efforts of the United Nations and other NGOs, we really don't have good numbers on the civilian toll. But we know that there's been immense suffering. And if history is any guide, it might be decades before someone is able to put together the full story of these wars, let alone the semi-covert campaigns in places like Pakistan and Yemen. So I think I think it might be some time before we're able to really say, you know, exactly what toll these wars have taken on civilians.
Do you think that, lastly, do you think it's that had by whatever, I mean, obviously, you know, age in and of itself would have been would have precluded you, but had it been possible, or had anyone been able to write this book closer to the conflict in terms of time? You know, you write the book nearly 30 years plus, 40 years plus from the end of the conflict. Had someone been able to write that book earlier, do you think that they would have been your book earlier? Do you think that we would have learned more? I mean, that would have affected the trajectory of our war making.
Well, of course, it's always hard to say with these things. But I did talk to one of the colonels. He retired as a general who worked on the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. And he was one of the men who kept these files secret. And, you know, I went to him and I talked to him about it. And he told me that at the time he thought it was the right thing to do. He thought it was for the good of the war effort, for the good of the country. But in the years since, he came to see it as a major mistake and a huge failing on his part. You know, I was interviewing him while the Iraq War was still raging. And he said to me, you know, if these had been made public at the time, he didn't think that there would have been the Abu Ghraib torture scandal. He thought if these records had an airing during or even directly after the Vietnam War, that it would have caused a major reevaluation within the Pentagon, and maybe the current atrocity scandals could have been avoided. So, you know, someone who saw things from the inside definitely thought that was the case.
Nick Terse, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Thanks so much for your time today. And we obviously have a link up to your book at majority.fm. Thanks very much. And really, congratulations on writing what is a really incredibly important book, I think.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
All right, folks. We will now head into the second half of the program today, wherein we will discuss such stories as the sequester. We will take your phone calls and your IMs. We have a link up at the site at Majority FM for Kill Anything That Moves. Now, remember, you know, the fascinating thing is that you had John Kerry in the Winter Soldier hearings, basically outline, and I think in front of the Senate actually as well, outline these very charges that there were systemic atrocities taking place, that My Lai was not an isolated incident. And in many ways, that testimony has been vindicated. And I don't know. I mean, it makes you, it definitely makes you wonder what the implications of John Kerry's service and, frankly, Chuck Hagel's service, because it's almost impossible to conceive that he was not either a witness to, in some ways, you know, aware of these type of things going on. And it makes you wonder what the implications are going to be on their practice as cabinet members.
I was just thinking about how, you know, Bob Kerry actually came out that he directly had participated in a pretty significant massacre. So, but yeah, I've just thought of that.
Maybe. Yes. And it has always been a little cagey about it, in my mind, Bob Kerry. But all right, well, we're going to take a...
felt terrible, but still took the medal.
Yeah, what are you going to do? All right, we're going to head into the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. It is your support that keeps this program alive, allows for extensive interviews. You know, Nick Terse has been interviewed in many other places, but I like to think that, you know, we have the time and the, sort of the parameters to sort of go deeper into these topics than you can find just about anywhere else. So if you can afford to support this program, by all means, you're encouraged to do so. Other ways, click on our Amazon link. If you buy junk through Amazon, you might as well buy it through our link. You will notice no difference. We get a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea or chocolate, 10% discount, coupon code majority. See you in the better half.